broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Winter is sitting not far away on an old park bench, its green paint flaking and cracked. His brown coat is open, and he is peeling a tart apple he swiped in the market. His dead father's pocket knife, all the old man left him, turns the skin from the flesh in one sharp red ring. Smell the air, and there the blue edge, oiled and fine, grazes the tender hair at the top of your spine. James Keegan, Autumn Morning. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. My guest today is poet and professional Shakespearean actor James Keegan. James is the featured poet in the current edition of the Delmarva Review. For over 10 years, he's been a member of the resident acting company at the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse. In addition, James is an associate professor of English at the University of Delaware at the Georgetown campus. We're going to discuss James' poetry and his experience as a Shakespearean actor. We'll focus primarily on King Lear and the madness of the king. According to Shakespeare, what happens to the kingdom when the king is unbalanced? Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, James.
Thanks, Al. It's good to be here.
Shakespeare, how did you come to be, James, a Shakespearean actor?
Well, that's a good question. Well, it's actually not that surprising a thing. I of course, encountered Shakespeare when I was in high school in Queens in New York, but it didn't really strike me as much in the classroom. I think we did Julius Caesar and maybe Macbeth as high schoolers, but I don't recall it staying with me. When I got to college, I went to College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I was interested in theater. I'd done some theater in high school, and I was not pursuing acting as a vocation then, although I was very interested in it. But my Irish immigrant parents thought that was a terrible idea for a professional pursuit. But I did do it. I auditioned for Twelfth Night at Holy Cross, and I got cast as the drunken uncle, Sir Toby Belch, a part I've played a couple of times since. And I fell in love with the sound of the thing. And at the same time, I was fortunate enough, I was a sophomore then, I was fortunate enough to be taking a class with Professor Ed Callahan there, and he was just a marvelous professor, and I was taking the course in Shakespearean tragedy. So while I was in Twelfth Night, I was also learning all this stuff about the tragedies, and particularly King Lear, and those two plays have remained my two favorite Shakespeare plays. I think Twelfth Night is my favorite comedy, and maybe my favorite play in the world. It's a dead heat between the two of them. I think King Lear is one of the great literary constructions in our language, one of the great poetic constructions. So... And then I just I came back to acting later on after I was a professor. I missed it, and I started to do it on an amateur basis. And then I thought, I really want to do more than this, and I really would like to do Shakespeare. And so I started looking for ways to do that, become a professional actor in my mid to late 30s. And I've been working ever since. So I was very fortunate and got connected with the American Shakespeare Center and in this recreation of Shakespeare's indoor theater, the Blackfriars Playhouse. So it's a little bit of a time machine in some ways. You know, it's not just doing Shakespeare, but doing Shakespeare the way Shakespeare did it. And I've been fortunate to play a lot of great roles there in a true rep ensemble. So it's with a dozen other actors doing four or five plays at a time, you know, in rotation. So it's just been a great way to work. And for somebody who came back to acting late, it's been a hell of a great way to catch up because you do so many plays in such a short space of time. So it's been great.
Well, Macbeth, in our conversations earlier, you've talked about Macbeth. And I noticed that you have a poem in the Delmarva Review that I would like to ask you to read. It's called Macbeth at the LZ, Waiting for the Evac. And
it's an interesting title.
It's a very interesting title, and it's a very interesting take on Macbeth as well. And I'd like to ask if you would read that poem and talk about it for just a moment.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I got to play Macbeth a few years ago. I've been in the play multiple times. I played lots of different characters, and then a few years back, I got to play the Scotsman himself, and it was a great experience. I got to play across from an actor who I really love and respect as Lady Macbeth, Sarah Fallon, and she was wonderful to work with. But as I was preparing for that role, I started to think about who Macbeth is as a soldier, and he and Banquo are described in the opening scenes of the play before we ever meet them. They're described as their fierceness in battle is described, and that they are simply coated in blood, and that they are when their backs are against the wall, they get even more terrifying. So I had done some work with teaching the Iliad and the Odyssey, and at the time when I was teaching the Iliad a number of years back, a doctor named Jonathan Shea, who worked with the Veterans Hospital in Boston, worked with a lot of Vietnam vets. And that's sort of the first war of my memory. You know, in my lifetime, I remember registering that was happening and hearing people talking about it. And I was too young to have been called up to that kind of service, but I remember all the political sort of fear and anger that revolved around that. And one of the things that Shea talks about in that book, it's called Achilles in Vietnam. And it's about combat trauma and PTSD primarily. And there's a lot of indications in Shakespeare that Macbeth is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and that he hasn't been properly reintegrated back into the culture after coming back from war. And Shakespeare shows this elsewhere with a character named Hotspur in the Henry plays. But so that's what was in my mind. And so I updated Macbeth to being at the landing zone, waiting to be evacuated. So it's Macbeth at the LZ, waiting for evac. And he's talking about where he is as a warrior at this moment, not quite ready to come back into the culture. So this is it, Macbeth at the LZ, waiting for evac. I fling a stone to sting the wicked crow that jabs an eye from some defeated face. I am the mad thing no one claims to know, spitting bone bits in this visceral space, this brief between, where I will breathe, wipe clean my knife, report no words to powers that be. Who should I answer to? I'm a machine that clangs in now. I have no history. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. The sound my blood still makes inside my head. You cling to your tomorrows, yesterdays. I am the now that falls across the dead. There will be time for water, water for my skin, to turn it right side out again, water to wash the taste of iron ore from me. It's blood, I know. It is the sin that is no sin, the justice blade of war. They tell you it's a gavel that's been honed. Somewhere, a woman's waiting by a door to wash you with a bowl and get you stoned. She'll kiss you, call you her astounding now. For your hard use, she'll bite your lip and moan. Just leave the heather littered with the how. Thrust into her like flesh and speak like stone. Water is what we need. We don't need talk. Oh, bring me home with water on my head, across my chest, my arms and legs, my cock. Bathe me like the old hags scrub the dead. Sing me to quiet in the hooded night, and whisper to me that I was a dream. Kiss closed the wounds, and soothe the bitstream fright, and serve up sweetness all in clotted cream. Yes, I will kill for you. I'll die for you. I'll charge into the bloody heart of pain. But you must tell me what I did is true. And wash me, damn you. Bring me home again.
Bring me home again.
Yeah.
What is the sense of bring me home again?
Well, here's what I think. In that book, Achilles in Vietnam, one of the things that Shea touches on that was different about the Vietnam War was that soldiers were returned so quickly and separate from their units. And so they didn't get a time to adjust to what they had been through and to debrief from it. Soldiers coming back from World War II, they were rotated in and out in units. They had trained with the same unit. And so they also were transported largely by ship.
There were no 2 weeks.
So they had a hiatus. Long time to sort of debrief on what they had been through and adjust to return to society. Not that that was always perfect. Certainly, you know, they suffered from PTSD as well. But the incidence of it in veterans was higher. And so I thought about this with Macbeth, because I think one of Macbeth's great errors is that, and his wife eggs him onto this, and it's a mistake, is that she takes the warrior Macbeth, and he takes the warrior Macbeth, who is so effective in the field. But when he comes home, there's a different set of rules, as there is in war and home. You know, it's like, I have to be reintegrated into the society. And a lot of ancient cultures have actually rituals to cleanse the warrior when they come home and to take away the berserker. Like, you know, Achilles is a berserker in the field, and you can't have that in your town, right? That's lethal. So part of what the mistake Macbeth makes is he kills inside of his own home. He breaks the code of hospitality, and he kills his own kinsman, his own king, out of his own ambition. And his wife eggs him on by poking at his courage and his manliness. And she's saying, you know, if you're a man, you'd commit to what you did and you'd do it. And he has, in the meantime, settled soliloquy to the audience that says, this is wrong, I can't do this. And she catches him right at that point where, right after he's decided that, and she eggs him back onto it, you know. And so, and they're both destroyed by it as a result.
So in your poem, you're dealing with two people here. You're dealing with the killer.
Right.
And then you're dealing with him on the verge of reentry.
Right, as the man as part of society,
as a
lover, a husband. And I think, you know, having known a few veterans who suffered from PTSD, I think, and it just the reintegration is so difficult. You know, when you wake in the middle of the night sweating and you walk the perimeter of your house for no reason and things like that, and you can't sit in open spaces comfortably and things like that. You know, I think the desire to be brought back home is very strong. It's like I'm dislocated, you know, I'm disjointed. And I think Shakespeare knew about these things. I think he just,
it's
you know,
fascinating
he tapped into them.
Knew about
and,
these
well, it
things.
Seems pretty clear in some of the speeches and some of the symptoms that Macbeth has after he commits this violence, his sleeplessness. You know, his obsessiveness, his unwillingness to share with his wife anymore what's happening with him, things like that.
Well, you have another poem.
I do.
That you wrote some time back.
I've tinkered with it for a long time.
Well, I just wanted to. It's Lazarus dies for the second time, and I think it's. A really very, very interesting piece. There are two Lazarus in the Bible. As you
right.
know, there was the Lazarus and the rich man
right.
by the gate in Luke.
Right. Right. That's the one that Falstaff refers to in Shakespeare.
Oh, is that right? So Lazarus. Yeah. And the one in the poem you're going to read now is from John 11. Yeah, right. Lazarus of Bethany, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. You know, as I read these poems, James, I found a relationship between this poem and the Vietnam poem that you just read. But I'd like to ask you to read Lazarus Dies for the second time, and we'll talk about it for just a moment.
Sure. This is one of the stories from the I get hung up on stories, and I was raised in an Irish Catholic household, so I heard Bible stories quite a bit, and Lazarus being raised from the dead prior to sort of the central element of Christian ritual, Jesus' own resurrection from the dead, struck me as, you know, kind of giving the trick away before you do the trick kind of a thing, you know, and I always thought it was strange that he's raised someone from the dead, and then so, you know, he's raised from the dead himself later on. Seemed an odd thing in the story. But then I thought, well, what must it be like to have been raised from the dead, but then to know that you're mortal and you have to die again, you know? So that's sort of what the poem is about. How would Lazarus apprehend that, and how would he deal with it? Lazarus dies for the second time. The final sun has come to me again. I would not ask a soul to pray it off. The former dullness seeps into my brain, and my lungs heave out a rattling cough that sounds familiar in my failing ears. The man who one time called me back is dead himself. He will not order me out into the years this time. I've heard that voice ring in my head on every day of my recovered life, bringing me back to myself from an idea that no matter how I've tried, I cannot half recall. What was it like? They asked. Did you see a place that looked like paradise? The face of the Lord, angels singing in the skies? Lazarus, one said, you have been dead 4 days. What was it like? I thought of several lies to make their questions stop, but said instead, death is no place for the living to speak of. If I sat down with God and ate of the soul's bread, or fell into the sun and burned with heaven's love until I blazed, if I could tell you so, would it change a blessed thing you do? Would death be any more a place you'd long to go? Where I was today, other than here with you, I cannot say, except I say, the grave. I do remember a turning around to the hard sound of my name. The voice gave me no choice in the matter. When I found myself alive and bound blind with cloths, I could make out a vague light ahead and my name, I thought. I stood there like a lost child, unable to move because he's so afraid of drifting deeper into dark, until his father's voice commands him to come with a sternness to shove all the stark fears back. Lazarus, come out. The child understands that the man expects to be obeyed, and so I understand that I am being again ordered out to be saved. I understand. Yet I confess I am afraid to die. I have heard that in his final moment the rabbi believed he'd been forsaken by his own father. I wept at that, since it meant that one who'd conquered death in me could be so shaken by his own living as to forget what he knew. No place for the live man to speak of is death. No place for the risen man to go out into when all his flesh tells him is how to take next breath
and love the bright and biting air. So, death, come forth. I was not born to be anything more than what I am, what I felt blessed with in rebirth. Alive, dancing alive on the broad steps at death's own door.
It's a longer poem.
It's a wonderful poem,
and I
think it goes extremely well, quite frankly, with the other poem that you read, in the sense that if we can take some liberties with interpreting and understanding the poem, is that Lazarus, in a sense, is your young man in Vietnam, and he is being called out. He is being called out to a new beginning. And this death in Vietnam is nothing to talk about.
Oh, that's interesting.
This is nothing we
made that connection.
This is nothing we want. Mm-hmm. This is nothing we want to talk about.
Yeah.
And this coming home from Vietnam is a new beginning. And also for Lazarus, this is a new beginning. And the young man from Vietnam knows that he is going to have to die again anyway, as does Lazarus. And so I saw... I don't know if this makes any sense.
No, it makes sense to
you,
me. I should say that I don't see the Macbeth poem as specifically being about Vietnam. I see it as being... I mean, that's sort of my reading experience that's behind it. But I see it as being more... reading through Macbeth's experience, sort of the experience of any combat individual who has to wade into that kind of, you know, scenario and then reintegrate into a society of laws and rules and morals. And, you know, when we've been pushed over that edge. And I think I see what you're saying, that Lazarus, too, has been pushed over that edge into something that he never
that we don't speak
on.
Of.
Well, we don't speak of it, or that we are unable to speak of.
Or that we can't speak
And I think
of.
Veterans often feel that way, that if, unless it's with other veterans, you know. And I've heard stories where Shay tells stories in that book where veterans, their family asked them, you know, tell us what it was like. And so they tried to, and there were just looks of horror on everybody's face, and nobody knew what to say. And they're like, well, I'm never doing that again.
In writing the poem, and for you, but for me, and for I think many in our listening audience, they do not have the same relationship to Macbeth that you
no,
do.
No, clearly not.
And so you wrote the poem and read the poem with Macbeth in your mind. However, for those of us who were active during the Vietnam era, who dealt with these young men coming home, your poem is primarily for us.
Oh, I grant
about Vietnam, and as a result, what I saw anyway was the connection with Lazarus, of Lazarus coming out of the grave to his new beginning, only to know that he's going to have to die again, go through this again. And in the Macbeth poem, these young men coming home from this death, knowing that they were going to have to be somebody else in this other world.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
For me, the
relationship was striking.
Hadn't noticed it, but thank you, Hal. I now see it.
Well, sometimes we never know what
no,
we
I
write.
Know.
The profundity, we never know what profundity we are pulling forth. Well, let's turn to Shakespeare now. And the Mad King. Primarily, what and begin, James, with Why is Shakespeare important to us today? And particularly, why is Lear important to us?
Well, it's a big question, the question that you ask. I imagine lots of people would have different answers to it. We're still producing Shakespeare and putting it on the stage, and audiences are still flocking to see it all around the world, So 400 years later, we have to acknowledge that this genius had something going, that other people don't have going. The first thing I think is the two elements are the beauty of the language and the fact that something, poetic is happening with the language, and that we are drawn into that. I know that I was drawn into that originally. The opening of Twelfth Night, if music be the food of love, play on, give me excess of it. It's like something's happening there right away from the jump. And I may not cognitively be able to take it apart right away, but as so often happens with poetry, I think our sense begins to ride the sound and the meaning comes along, I've had friends come to Shakespeare productions I'm in, it's funny, and some of them were resistant, they had bad experiences with Shakespeare in high school or the like, and they're like, I'll come to it because you're in it. And I asked them later on, well, what did you think? And they said, in the first couple of scenes where you're talking that funny way, I didn't really like it. But when you started to speak more regularly, and, it didn't change. It was just they got used to it. And, well, they also got to see it, so often I think in the classroom we read it. And Shakespeare didn't write it to be read. He wrote it to be performed. He was a man of the theater. And so I think that when you marry the action to the word and the words to the action, people start to connect with it. But I also think he just touched on every human emotion and passion, and he drew characters that when we see them, we still feel like, I see them. I know who they are, and I understand them. And they respond in ways to the world that I can identify with, and even when they're kings and the like, I think that, we see King Lear is a king, but he's also an old man under the pressures of what it means to be an old man. And he's someone who's held power for a long time. And that can be very damaging to one's ability to access oneself on a human level. In Shakespeare, the king has two aspects. He has the public, he is the public body, and he is his own body. And but if, the opening of King Lear, he says, attend the lords of France and Burgundy, give me the map there, know that we have divided in three our kingdom. Every single thing he says is an imperative, yeah. And as soon as he says it, it happens. And that doesn't happen for most of us, So this is the human, where the word and the action that follows it are almost the same thing. And that's the power of the God. The God says, and it becomes, And so a human shouldn't have that kind of power for too long, because it'll corrupt. And it'll take us away from our humanity. And I think Lear's journey in the play, the reason that the play holds so much moment for us, is it's the journey to find the self,
Well, I'm going to ask you to tell us in just a minute, give us a broad synopsis. Outline yeah, of sure. the of the play. But
I'm not going to assume that all of our listeners have read or seen King Lear.
Or immersed in Macbeth or in King Lear. But in terms of its importance, the importance of Shakespeare, let me just mention, and I'm sure you're very familiar with, the great a literary critic and professor at Yale University, Harold Bloom, has a book,
The Invention of the Human,
out on the canon of Western literature.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And he places Shakespeare at the base of the canon of Western literature. And he argues in this book that Cervantes, that Borges, that Dante, that all Check of the off. Great writers, you look at Shakespeare, and Shakespeare has anticipated the human base that they draw from. And so you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that the insights that Shakespeare had and displays in his plays and in the sonnets as well is so vast. And I think Harold Bloom would argue that you were probably correct.
I'd have to argue that Harold Bloom was correct. I think it would have to go that way.
That Harold Bloom is correct by putting Shakespeare at the at the base of our Western literary.
He has another great book about Shakespeare as well, called Shakespeare: The Invention of the Human, and it speaks. The title itself speaks exactly to what you're talking about. And Bloom's, you know, perspective on that is that you have not just characters being invented here, but Shakespeare invents what it means to be human in the modern era by virtue of the plays. Yeah.
Well, tell us what he invents in Lear, the Mad King.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in many ways, Lear is such a modern play. Its fundamental structure seems almost fairy tale like, and it comes from an old folk tale, folk legend of an ancient English king. But the story is fundamentally that Lear has reached a great age, and he mentions in the play that he's probably somewhere in his early 80s. But when I played the role, we cut that line because I was a little bit older than I was, or substantially older than I was. But he has three daughters, and two of them are already married. They're childless, which is an interesting feature, too. So there's no heirs that have been produced by either of those marriages. And so both his older daughters, Goneril and Regan, are wedded to Albany and Cornwall, specifically, respectively. That's the word I was looking for. And then he has a younger daughter, Cordelia, who is of marriageable age. And there are two suitors looking to marry her, Burgundy and France. And the King of France and the Duke of Burgundy, who would have been political equals at the time. So Lear seems to have taken this as his cue, since he's marrying off the last daughter, his cue to dispense dowries to all three daughters, and he's made this decision to divide the kingdom. And critics have made a lot of the fact that, you know, this would have been for Shakespeare's audience a horrific idea, you know, this notion of divvying up the kingdom, because it's no longer a kingdom, and of course you break its very nature. And its nature is that it will seek to reunite. So there's some of that in the play. But also it's this desire on Lear's part to retire from the cares and responsibilities of kingship, but to retain the title and privileges thereof. And that's a problematic idea, right? To retain all the privileges but not have to do the work. He also makes the mistake of basing his division of the kingdom, even though he seems to have already decided the thirds that the daughters will get, he requires that they express their love for him in order for him to dispense the peace. And he's got two daughters who are very willing to do that, effusively. And then he's got a younger daughter who's very like him and is stubborn, and who also looks at the value of language and the word, that the word is not to be corrupted. And she and several other characters in the play are married to this idea that you do your actions first and then you talk about it. And you don't say something that's not possible. You know, like one daughter says, "I love you more than anything." And then the next daughter says, I feel exactly the same as my sister. I would have said exactly what she said, only she doesn't say enough. Which is impossible. If she said exactly what you would say, then that's it. You don't say anything. But they understand their father, that he wants his ego stroked, and so they stroke the ego. And Cordelia refuses to do so. And he gets furious at the narcissistic side of him, the side that needs this. And I think it's a side that's not secure in its identity, either as a father or as a man, that needs this. You know, and he banishes her. And that leads to other banishments when other people stand up to him. And, of course, the daughters who have expressed this love and then are supposed to care for him then decide, well, you don't have any power now, so we don't necessarily have to honor those terms, and it's inconvenient for us. So, and that leads to him being driven out from their houses and going out into the storm, which is the famous part of the play, that he goes out into the storm. He's an old man, accompanied only by a fool, another character who's pretending to be a madman, and another character, Kent, who has been loyal to him, has been banished, but is so loyal that he comes back in disguise to serve him. So he's another kind of fool. Anybody who'd be banished on pain of death but still come back, a lot of people would look at that person with that level of loyalty as foolish. So he's in the storm, a madman with a pretend madman and two fools. So it's the picture of you know, moving toward the lowest and the break with the rational, to come to break with his rational perception of things, where he has quantified everything or made things quantifiable, and to get him to acknowledge that life is not about quantifying things. It is about the quality of who you are and your relationships. And not even talking about the subplot. There's a subplot with a father and two sons, and one son is honest and Edgar, and another son is a bastard son, and he's dishonest, and he too is governed by a word, the word bastard, that the culture puts on him, right, puts him in a certain place, and he rejects that notion. He rebels against it, and so he betrays his brother, and that's the brother who disguises himself as a madman. So I'm trying to be succinct about the plot, but I think it's getting away from me.
Well, I know it's really hard. But Edmund is important because Edmund it kind of drives the plot to its conclusion and to its very bloody conclusion. In a sense.
Well, he's a wounded party, but he embraces villainy. He embraces the villainous side, as do Lear's daughters, the two eldest daughters, and so they get caught up with each other too. He and they, in psychosexual kind of relationships with one another, and also relationships of power, as they because Cordelia comes back, the youngest daughter comes back from France with an army.
Well, there's something to defend about a her war father. Here.
Yeah, and then there's a war between the sisters' powers. And in all the original source material, Lear and his daughter Cordelia win, but not in Shakespeare. Shakespeare decides to turn it the other way.
Now, what, say that again?
Well, in the source material that Shakespeare uses to write the play, the ending is different. The ending is happy.
What is the source material?
Well, there's the legend of King Lear. The story is extant in a number of source materials that Shakespeare used, Holinshed's Chronicles and a few others. And then there was also a previous play previous to Shakespeare's called King Lear, and he uses pieces of that. The Gloucester plot comes almost entirely from Spenser's Arcadia, and there's been no association prior to Shakespeare of this Gloucester story and the two sons and Lear. He puts those two together and mingles them, sees a relationship between them, and rightly so, I think. And so we get Gloucester, who is an old man who is blind to the true nature of his sons, and his blindness ends up in his being actually blinded. And then we have these two old men meet later in the play. You know, one gone out of his mind, Lear, lost touch with his rational sense. But somehow, as a result of that, there's reason in his madness, and he has new insights into what the truth is and who he is. And then we have Gloucester, who has been literally physically blinded, and at the moment of his physical blindness, sees the truth about which son was loyal. And so he, too, has learned to, as he says in the play, to see the world feelingly.
Well, wrap this up for us with the ending, James, and then we'll go back to the beginning.
Okay, so this is a spoiler
alert. We'll talk
alert.
About the progressive madness of of the king, or the madness of the king all the way from the beginning to the end.
Yeah. Okay. This is going to spoil the play plot wise for people, but the great thing about Shakespeare is it's so rich that even when you know the ending, it doesn't really matter. I'm going to solace myself with that observation. So, Cordelia comes back to try to defend her father. In the meantime, Lear has been driven out by his daughters. They are, have heard that Cordelia's power has landed from France, and they are arming to fight her. And, meantime, Lear has lost everyone at this point and lost his mind, and he's out on the heath. as they say in reference to it. And he's mad, and she has sent people out searching for him. She finds him, and in one of the most beautiful scenes in all of Shakespeare, she brings him back to himself, and she forgives him. And it's this beautiful, and she's very much a Christian figure, even though the play, all the Christian elements, Shakespeare has excised most of them. But there is a point at which Cordelia says, I must be about my father's business. So it's a direct allusion to Christ. And she can be seen as a kind of Christ figure in there, in this, she's so deeply connected to forgiveness. And at this point, Lear, says to her, I am old and foolish. And he has this acknowledgement of who he really is and what he's, what's really true about him. And they, the battle goes on, and they should win. This is everything in us wants them to win, of course, and we're aligned with them, and they don't. As so often happens in life, the good guys don't always win, and they lose, and they're taken away to prison, and sent to prison by this bastard son of Gloucester, Edmund, who has power at that point, and he puts an order of execution on their heads. So his brother comes back, and they end up having a duel, and Edgar wins back the right of his name, and he mortally wounds his brother Edmund. And before Edmund dies, he says, I want to do some good. He says, my writ is on the life of Lear and Cordelia. Send my sword and stop it from happening. But he's too late on one. So Cordelia is hanged in the prison. Even though her father tries to stop it, he can't. And so in the final scene of the play, a shattering scene, this old man, Lear, comes walking out howling like an animal with his daughter's dead body in his arms. And then the rest of the scene takes place with him still holding on to her, having her nearby. It's often seen as a kind of pietà, with him cradling this Christ figure in his arms, his poor fool, as he says. And then he dies of broken heart, excess of experience, a stroke, depends on how you look at it. And his other daughters have meantime died in one way or another. So it's a typical Act Five of Shakespeare. The stage is littered with bodies, but this one is sort of shattering in that there's a sense of great loss. And even though Edgar sort of has the last word, and you have a sense, okay, the state is going to reboot itself, you have a feeling that it won't be with the same kind of power, and that people are deeply scarred by what's happened. And this is what has made people see the play as extremely modern play. It's been connected to plays by Beckett, and has a kind of existential power and focus that that made it very unpopular in the couple of centuries after Shakespeare. In fact, it was rewritten with a happy ending. The fool was removed, and it was played that way for hundreds of years, prior to it being reinstated. And it's great power and artistry acknowledged.
Track for us a little bit the madness of the king. How does the king display his illness?
Well, there's been, modern psychologists have sort of examined the text and tried to figure out, well, what is actually happening with Lear here? And is he bipolar? Is he moving toward dementia and having manic episodes, which I think is probably the closest one from what I've seen and in my limited knowledge of modern psychiatry. But that one seems to make the most sense in that he does come back from this madness and come back to rationality.
Well, how is that played out in the play?
Well, it's the beauty of Shakespeare again is that, a lot of it is open to interpretation. How are you going to view this man from the outset? Is he a powerful person who his ego has run riot? Or is he already showing some cracks? He worries a lot about madness, about going mad, which is not generally a trait of people who are already mad or who are moving toward that. And that's something that, modern psychological sort of examinations of the play have noted. But I think someone who is older, and might worry about dementia, might worry about, you know, in our time, Alzheimer's, you know, am I going to have to confront something like that? Is that going to be part of my experience? So I think you can view Lear as being mad from the outset. He chooses to divide the kingdom. Some people could.
Well, there's this narcissistic.
There's a narcissistic
in which he wants his daughters.
Well, and his older daughters, one older daughter says to the other, he did ever but slenderly know himself. You know, so it's about self-knowledge, too, that this person has had power for too long, perhaps, and it has warped his personality. The thing that is seen as the real mad act in the opening scene is not so much the division of the kingdom. People seem to be like, okay, that's what he's doing. It's politically perhaps unwise, but nobody seems hung up on that. What they get hung up on is his banishment of Cordelia. That seems the rash act. This is his favorite daughter. Everybody knows it's his favorite daughter. And yet he banishes her because she simply won't say what he wants her to say.
She wasn't exclusive enough.
It's not that she doesn't say. She says, you know, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those graces back as our right fit. You know, obey you, love you, and most honor you. And that's a beautiful thing for a child to say to a parent.
But not
after the two daughters have gilded the lily. The two other daughters, so it sounds less than. Kent steps up and says, you know, while I can vent clamor from my throat, I'll tell thee thou dost evil. You know, thy youngest daughter does not love thee least. You know, he says, so he steps up and says, this is madness. What would thou do, old man? He says to him. So the people who are his most trusted retainers confront him, and he banishes them too.
That's Kent.
This rage. Banished. And this giving into the impulsive rage, you know, and responding out of narcissistic impulsive action. We have no precedent for that in our own time, of course. It's the thing that causes the difficulty. He puts his faith in the wrong people, based on what they say. He looks totally at the surface, and he doesn't consider the depth. He also has this delusion that he can command power when he doesn't have the basis of it.
Well, the sense that he can give his kingdom away, but still be the king.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, former U.S. presidents are still called Mr. President, but they don't have any delusion that they're going to be signing executive orders, you know. So it's a problematic situation, and it's what requires his rejection and his... To me, it's what requires it. He has to get himself stripped away. And that's what we see, a stripping away. The daughters don't let him have his 100 nights with him.
This is kind of a symbolic stripping away of his power.
You get 25, you get 10, you get 5.
Right.
What do you need one for?
Right.
You know, and that's when he says, at one point, confronting his daughters, he says, "Oh, reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest thing superfluous. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is cheap as beasts. If only to go warm were gorgeous, why, nature needs not what thou gorgeous wearest, which scarcely keeps thee warm. But for true need, you heavens, give me that patience I need. You see me here, you gods, a poor old man, as full of grief as age, wretched in both. If it be you that stirs these daughters' hearts against their father, fool me not so much to bear it tamely. Touch me with noble anger, and let not women's weapons, water drops, stain my man's cheeks. No, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall... I will do such... things. What they are yet, I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or ere I'll weep. Oh, fool, I shall go mad." So this is at the moment right before he goes out into the storm. His daughters have told him, you know, let us run it the way we want to run it. And he says, don't reason about this. Don't make this logical. I need what I need. The basest beggars in our world, the poorest people out there, need little extras, need little luxuries, you know, to feel human, he says.
You know, so this doesn't sound like madness, though.
No, this is, well, this is a man who is starting to crack. He's starting to realize, oh, my God, what have I done? I've given away to these daughters who later are compared to beasts, to tigers, not daughters, tigers. And there's a lot of bestial image in the play and a lot of image of the body in torture. So this is Shakespeare looking at the very foundation of our humanity, our bodies, and how vulnerable we are. And this old man has just said, you know, I'll go out in the storm. I won't have a house over my head. You know, he makes this threat. And they're like, and there's a storm outside. You hear it during this speech. They're sort of, go ahead.
And he goes out
and
into the storm.
And he goes out into the storm.
So what happens in the storm?
Well, he rages at the skies a bit like he can command them. And that's part of, again, that delusion. But the most important thing that happens is that he encounters the other vitally important person in the play, and I think that is Edgar. The play is about Lear, but it's also about Edgar's education as a young man. And so the two plots cross here in the mad scene. Edgar has made this leap. He has been accused of something, of seeking his own father's life. His brother has created a letter, supposedly written by him. His father has believed it. And he's had to go on the run. Immediately when he has to go on the run, he has a genius idea. He decides to hide in plain sight by taking on the trappings of a madman. You know, like we might see, I remember going to high school, passing by a park where the buses stopped, Hoffman Park, and there were benches out there, and there were schizophrenics and homeless people, you know, homeless schizophrenics all over the place. You know, you'd run into them all the time. And this is the kind of person that he chooses to be, the person that you learn over time to ignore and to not identify as a person that I think that we in our culture very often learn to ignore because they're terrifying, because there but for the grace of whatever go I. What might change in my life that could put me in that position, right? And so Edgar, in his soliloquy, talking to the audience about this, says, Edgar, I nothing am. And he decides, he immediately, and nothing is a very important word in the play, and it's the thing that Lear has to realize, that he's not special. He's, as the Dalai Lama would say, he's one of the 7 billion people, you know? And there weren't 7 billion then, but that's what the Dalai Lama says now. You know, I am one of the 7 billion people, to keep his ego in check and to remind him that he's not special, you know, that he's just another life on this planet. And so Lear, right before he meets Edgar in disguise, Edgar's disguised as Tom of Bedlam. And Bedlam is a word for us that means chaos, but it comes from the fact that there was a hospital called Bethlehem Hospital in Shakespeare's time and after that catered to the mentally ill or, you know, catered to them. I mean, wasn't able to treat them in any kind of meaningful way, but it gave them a place to be, and often they would move out from there. So the word Bethlehem got shortened to Bedlam, and so Tom of Bedlam is this mad figure, and Edgar impersonates somebody who's mad as a way of hiding in plain sight. When Lear encounters him, Lear sees himself. So he sees an external representation, a stripped down version, and he starts asking this guy, oh, did your daughters do this to you? You know, so he starts to see an external representation of himself, his own, and then he starts to strip off his own clothing. He's trying to get down to just the man. You know, and he says to Edgar when he meets him on the heath, he says, thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more than this, than what you are, right? So he says, art thou no more than this? Unaccommodated man is no more than this, a poor bare forked animal. And so that's sort of an acknowledgement that Lear is coming to knowledge. But right before that, he has this beautiful moment where they're trying to get him to go into this hovel and to seek shelter from the storm. And he says, first I want to pray. And so he kneels down alone on the stage. This is right before Edgar enters as a madman. And he says, poor naked wretches. So he's saying this right to the audience. Poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, that bide the pelting of this pitiless storm. How shall your houseless heads and unfed sides, your looped and windowed raggedness,
defend you from seasons such as these. Oh, I have taken too little care of this. So there's a king suddenly realizing, I've never paid attention to those people. You know, I've not thought about those people. And here I am suddenly about to be one of those people. And I have a new vision of it. You know, when the mind's free, the body's delicate, he says at one point, you know. But if the mind doesn't have that kind of freedom, then the body gets subjected to this privation. And so it's that privation that he has to go through in the storm. And eventually he loses the fool, he loses Edgar, he loses Kent. No, they lose him in the course of the storm, and he loses his wits.
But even though everybody almost dies in the end of this, there is a recovery. There is a forgiveness. Say something about that.
Well, the most beautiful scene in the play to me is when Cordelia, who has no reason to come back, she has returned to help her father, and she finds him in this mad state. She gets a doctor to administer to him, and she has them play harmonious music around him and bring him back to his senses. Music is so important. And when he wakes and he sees her there, first he says, you do me wrong to take me out of the grave. So there's Lazarus again. You do me wrong to take me out of the grave.
Yeah.
Thou art a soul in bliss.
The grave is the madness, though.
Right. But
he's hoping he's died.
Too. He's hoping that he's died. So he says, you do me wrong to bring me back to this life. You do me wrong to take me out of the grave. And he sees his daughter as a spirit. He says, thou art a soul in bliss, but I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead. And so he's trying to figure out where he is at one point, and he says to her, methinks I should know you and know this man, and that's Kent, yet I am doubtful. For I am mainly ignorant what place this is, and all the skill I have remembers not these garments, nor know I not where I did lodge last night. Do not laugh at me, for as I am a man, I think this lady to be my child, Cordelia. And she says, and so I am, I am. And he says, be your tears wet, and he touches the tears on her face. And he says, yes, Faith, if you have poison for me, I will drink it. I know you do not love me, for your sisters have, as I do remember, done me wrong. They have some cause. You have some cause. They have not. And she says the most beautiful words in the play to me. She says, no cause. And then she says it again, no cause. And I think a lot of playwrights would have written no cause, but only Shakespeare would have been smart enough to repeat it. So at the first one is she's saying, I have no cause to be angry with you. Even though she does. So that's real forgiveness. I'm not just forgiving, but forgetting. And then she says it a second time to make sure that he hears it. And then she asks if he wants to go inside. And he says, you must bear with me. I am old and foolish. Well, he says, you must bear with me. Pray you now, forget and forgive. I am old and foolish. And she does forgive him. And so it looks like they're going to be happy. But then they're sent to prison. And you get this horrific ending where he says, my poor fool is hanged. Thou'lt come no more. Never, 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 never. Five nevers. Astounding line of poetry, you know. And each of those nevers is him coming to the full realization of what it means to lose somebody in the mortal world, what we all feel in that moment.
Whom he banished at the beginning, which is the irony.
He'll never get to be with her again, and that seems to break him. Yeah, and so the play is so much about the edges of our humanity and the extremes of our humanity. For me, I think that's why people acknowledge it as this great work.
James.
Yeah.
Let me say that I think, first of all, that your students are very, very fortunate to have
you. I'm not sure they'd agree with you, but...
Well, that's because they're too young to understand. But your knowledge, your ability with the language, understanding how important the language is in this play, is just wonderful. Yes. And as I say, I look forward someday to seeing you in this role. But I do want to say how fortunate I think your students are to have you.
Thanks.
As a professor. You're what a wonderful discussion of this play.
Thanks.
Thank you,
oh,
very much for being here.
It's been a delight.
And thank you for your recitation of this beautiful language. Let me end our broadcast today with a note for the writing community. The Eastern Shore Writers Association and the Delmarva Review are sponsoring a nonfiction writing contest called Delmarva Voices, and it's for writers in the Delmarva area. Please visit the Delmarva Review website for details on the writing contest. The contest is judged by Laura Oliver, someone who is familiar to a lot of us in the Delmarva area. Laura is a writing teacher at St. John's College in Annapolis, and she and her partner, Lynn Schwartz, are conducting a one-day workshop at St. John's College on the 3rd of June. And I'd like to ask you to check out the workshop on her website, LauraOliver2@yahoo.com. Let me come back again to you, James, and thank you once more for being on Delmarva Today. Writer's Edition. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.